You shouldn't need a game plan just to get out of the car. Joint Relief Institute can help you. Fast, non-surgical, immediate pain relief and covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Okay, welcome to really a special edition of After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. It's the first time the show has ever been entirely devoted to one subject. The subject is a new book called Chili Dog MVP, Dick Allen, the 72 White Sox, and a transforming Chicago. It is by my old friend, John Owens, and another guy I've admired greatly, David Fletcher. Hello, fellas.
Hey, Rick.
Thanks, Rick.
So we're going to cover absolutely everything, because the book does, too. This is a very it is not simply about Dick Allen and the few years that he spent here and what a great ball player he was and what a complicated guy he was. It is the history of Chicago. It is the history of baseball here. It is the history of politics here. It is the history of race relations here. I'm going to use a great example from the foreword written by Hall of Famer Goose Gossage. Here is what baseball was like in the early 70s. Gossage eventually went to the Hall of Fame, but he writes in, and I just am stunned by this, and it really brings me back. At the end of 72 spring training, we traveled north from Sarasota to Chicago. They let us off the bus at Comiskey Park the night we went on strike. Here I am. Can't rub two nickels together and have no place to stay. I'm walking the streets of Chicago. I couldn't get in touch with my sister, LaVon, who lived in the suburbs, so I spent the night on the Chicago streets, scared to death, sleeping on a bench. Almost inconceivable, you guys. Almost inconceivable. How did this book come to be, John?
Well, so it started really in 2004. So I worked at the Tribune over 20 years. Worked with you, Rick, and I worked
on... We call that the golden age of the Tribune.
It definitely is the golden age of the Tribune.
It sure is.
Without a doubt. So I worked on a project that was related to something that the Sunday Magazine put together called Baseball in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It was a documentary called The City's Pastime, and it looked at Chicago baseball history. And as part of that, I interviewed David Fletcher, who was at that time part of a group called Clear Buck Weaver. This Buck Weaver was the disgraced third baseman for the Chicago White Sox, the Black Sox in 1919. Sox. Yeah. And he had always said that he was not involved in any cheating. And Dr. Fletcher was in, the head of that group and was working with Buck Weaver's family to try to clear his name. So we hit it off after that initial meeting for the documentary, and we worked together 4 years later on a documentary that I directed called Buck O'Neill and Black Baseball in Chicago. Buck O'Neill, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame this year,
right,
was a legendary Negro League manager. He was a scout for the Cubs for 30 years and a coach for the Cubs for 30 years, and an ambassador for baseball, also known for his appearance in Ken Burns's documentary Baseball. So we produced a half-hour documentary on Buck O'Neill. And then in 2012, we hooked up again because Doc had was working with the White Sox on a tribute to the 1972 White Sox. Yeah. It was the 40th anniversary back in 2012. And that was when I had the occasion to meet Dick Allen for the first time. He was a wonderful man, very humble, and very generous with his time. And then flash forward 8 years later, when Dick died in the fall of 2020, Doc reached out again and said, this is the time to really tell Dick's story and to tell the story of the 1972 White Sox. And we started writing it right
after
that.
David, you're a suburban kid.
Yes.
How did you get hooked on the way? And you're old enough to have gone to games the famous year of 1972.
Yes, I was. I was a senior in high school, and so I went to about 20 games that year. So I was definitely old enough, and grew up in the western suburbs, went to Glenbard West.
As a Sox fan?
As a Sox fan.
What is that, generational, or how did you become a Sox fan?
I was a Sox fan because I was a big baseball fan, and I actually like both teams. I'm going to admit that. And we were in Chicago. You had both the best of both worlds. It was, you could sometimes go see a Cubs game in the afternoon and then see the Sox at night. That was the ultimate baseball fantasy as a fan. But really, you know, fell in love with the Sox that year after some horrible years before that.
And you fell in love with Dick Allen.
Yes, I did. Here I am, a white kid growing up as a privileged kid in the western suburbs, and I just really was mesmerized by this black superstar who came on the scene like nothing else. And the city was waiting for a savior for the franchise. It was really floundering, and the Cubs were way out in front as far as the White Sox as a franchise. Fans weren't showing up there. People thought going to Comiskey Park was a scary experience. And they needed something that would transform and electrify the franchise. And he showed up.
He did. He did. The cover of this fantastic book, Chili Dog MVP, and we will certainly tell you why that is the title of this book. It has a beautiful illustration of not only Rich Allen juggling some kind of, not baseballs, but there's some kind of
pinwheels.
It is based on the famous Sports Illustrated cover of this man, but the only thing lacking in this illustration is a cigarette.
That's correct, and that's, well, one of the reasons.
We live in these politically correct
times.
Well,
yes, yeah. You also have to remember Dick was very embarrassed by this cover.
Yes, he was, I know.
Which I have to admit I still have up in my bedroom wall 50 years later. And, in fact, he died of lung cancer. And one of the things we're trying to do is a campaign, an anti-smoking campaign, using this iconic Sports Illustrated
wow,
cover
that's great.
As a public service
that's
thing.
Good of
so,
you.
So he was very embarrassed toward the end of his life about that. And so I definitely was not going to have a cigarette this time around.
You, David Fletcher, got to know him very well at
I
the
did.
End of life, so well that you were a pallbearer at his funeral.
I was. I was honored to have that.
How did you get to know him?
Well, it was after I'd done the event in 2012. I became very close to his wife, Willa, second wife Willa, his kid, oldest kid that was still living, Doobie, which is Richard Allen II, and also his brother Hank, who was on the 72 White Sox. And we just really hit it off, and I told him that he never got his due in Chicago, and I had talked about the future, about doing a book. And we just stayed in close. We also worked on the Hall of Fame campaign we had for both Minnie Minoso and also for Dick in 2014. And he lost by one vote in 2014. It was a heartbreaking loss. I was with his son holding his hand in San Diego, and he lost by a whisker. It was horrible. And just became very close to him. And they sort of treated me like family. And so they also consulted me during his illness, which I was honored as a physician to provide some insight. And I made sure that Paul Sullivan of the Chicago Tribune got the last interview Dick ever did
before he
died.
I know.
And so they were just tremendous people to me.
One of the things about this book, and as I'm telling you, it is such a full, more than roughly 450 pages that reads like a great magazine article. I'm telling you guys.
Thank you.
That's quite a compliment.
When you decided to collaborate, did you decide immediately that what you needed to do was set Dick Allen in the larger world that was Chicago and politics and race?
That was definitely important to us to provide context for Dick Allen's, why Dick Allen was so important in the city, and to give readers an idea of what the city was like at the time.
Well, but also you have these remarkable characters, not ancillary characters at all, but these remarkable. If you were casting a play, for instance, called The Dick Allen Story, and you have, let's have this man Harry Carey come in and play a prominent part. Let's have this adorable, at the time, no offense, sexy organist.
I think she's still sexy now at 75.
All right, let me ask you a question about Nancy Faust. And we will, again, we're going to be on for the entire show till 7 o'clock. One of the most intriguing things about this book, and the book did bring back for me dozens and dozens of memories. I'm so intrigued by the fact that Nancy Faust and her husband, they live in the suburbs and with two donkeys. Please, one of you, explain the donkeys to me.
Why don't you go ahead?
I can. Well, after John Allen sold 80% of his ownership to Bill Veeck's conglomerate, December of 75, you know, she continued on as the organist for the White Sox, and it was part of a promotion that Bill had for the White Sox to give away a donkey, and Nancy inherited because the person who won it didn't want it.
Those donkeys can't be that old.
Well, they're not.
Are they that old?
She's replaced them since
then. She's replaced the donkeys. Yes. That is one of the most intriguing things of the million intriguing things in Chili Dog MVP, which you can order now. It is very astonishingly reasonably priced by Eckhart's Press, eckhartspress.com. Who publishes virtually every disc jockey who's ever been on this station.
but I like that plug.
This, I think, is their finest book. I really do. And I've read them all and had their authors on. It's a remarkable story. We got to take a short commercial break, but I'll continue on with John Owens and David Fletcher for the next hour and 15 minutes. We are talking this entire show about Chili Dog MVP. It is the story of Dick Allen, who played for the White Sox for a terribly short time. He always said later in life that if he had it to do over again, this would have been his place, because this is where I think he fell in love with baseball all over again, because he had a horrible time in Philadelphia. We'll get to that in a moment. But in 1973... after he'd been here for a year, Sports Illustrated had an article about him, not the famous cover shot article, and said in that piece, "Allen is the first black man and indeed the only contemporary man of color to assert himself in baseball with something like the unaccommodating force of Muhammad Ali in boxing, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in basketball, and Jim Brown in football. He is perhaps the best all-round player in the game today. He is certainly the most independent and highest paid. He came from very modest roots, one of eight children in a small town in Pennsylvania." He obviously was a prodigy, yes.
He certainly was.
He played great basketball, from what I understand from your book.
He was a tremendous basketball player. Their 1960 Wampum team, which from a very small school, is the state champs.
What's that town like? What's that town like?
Well, I've been to the town. I mean, it's not changed much since when he was there. Very small, about less than 5,000. It's a eastern Pennsylvania coal town. Actually, he actually grew up in a town adjacent to Wampum, Chudent, and that's where his funeral was at the Baptist church that he grew up in his entire life.
Mm. What was it about his parents, do you think, or just that place that imbued him with that kind of independent streak? You know, he didn't go to college, which, you know, Jabbar and Jim Brown and others might have been radicalized.
I think his older brother, Coy, was a big influence on him. Coy and his mother, Ira, were both great influences on him. Coy especially, because he was a tremendous athlete, but he grew up in a time when the baseball was still segregated, so he couldn't play Major League Baseball. But I think Coy taught Dick, you know, how to be, you know, his own person. It was Coy who talked to Dick about, you know, making sure he knew about his self-worth. So Dick Allen was notorious and famous for holding out for what he believed he was worth, and he did that every year. And as a result, he was the highest paid player in baseball.
You know, this is at a time, too, where no one was signing multi-year contracts. But he was, even with Hank Aaron playing as a contemporary, he was the highest paid ball player.
He was. After the 1972 MVP season, he got the highest contract ever in baseball, $225,000 a year for a 3-year deal. So he was at the top of his game. But also when he was signed by the Phillies in 1960, he got a $70,000 bonus signing, which was the highest ever for a while.
But as an example, too, of the times, and we're talking about more than 50 years ago, and sometimes in reading your book, it seems like it was 100 years ago. How at spring training he roomed with a guy, and they had to room in a funeral parlor. They had to sleep in a funeral parlor because they were not allowed in hotels.
And that definitely affected him because he grew up in Wampum, which was, you know, he grew up with whites, and
yeah.
You know, he played against white people, and it was an integrated town. And then when he played in Little Rock in the early 60s, it was just a complete culture shock to him, and it really affected him for the rest of his career.
When also his greeting in Philadelphia was anything but friendly, and it sounds in terms here, and I know this history, I'm old, almost horrific. The kind of Philly's always been a racially divisive and divided city, but he was abused.
Well, he certainly was in Philadelphia, and in fact, in 2020, right before he died, the Phillies retired his number, and Dick invited me to go there as his special guest. I was the only person from Chicago that went there, and the owner of the Phillies apologized to him and used an analogy that Dick was like John Lewis, and he spoke out when he had to right a wrong. And that was, for me, was very, very emotionally charging, because he's basically apologized for the city of Philadelphia, how he was treated, and how the Phillies sent Dick as a young 20-year-old down to Little Rock, which just a few years before the segregation stuff.
Yeah.
He was just horrible experience. And, you know, he came out the most beloved player that year, and he was brought up to the majors September of 1963.
But, you know, given the time and given the era and given the racial divisiveness of this entire country, that is something, to my mind, that made him stronger. I mean, there are many human beings, talented as they might be, who would crumble under that.
It made him stronger, but conversely, I think that it really affected him negatively, and I think that he had sort of a mini breakdown during his last couple of years in Philadelphia. I mean, Philadelphia, the Phillies were always known as a team that wasn't particularly friendly towards players of color.
Yeah.
So he felt that, and he contended with that, and he jumped ship. He left the team for a period of time in the late 60s because of, you know, he had, you know, issues with management. So
it also fueled. I'm thinking we haven't even gotten into the whole media surrounding Dick Allen and the media in this town and other places too. But it started to fuel what was a nascent drinking problem that he had, did it not? That this is how he decided to ease the pain?
Yeah, well, you want to talk about that?
Well, he certainly had some occasions where he drank too much, but he really was never really an alcoholic.
Right.
And this is something I addressed a lot later in life with him when he was accused of this. It was just a way for him to cope.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
Again, you have to remember there's a reserve clause. He has no ability to go to another team, to control who's in charge of him. And that's why he was really a landmark player, because he did promote his own self-worth and held out and got great contracts. But we also have to remember he was the one traded for Curt Flood.
Right.
And he knew that Curt Flood was going to do that when the trade happened. And so you have to remember the times that was going on. And in fact, we quote Marvin Miller about Dick, about how elegant and erudite he was about the whole issue about promoting your self-worth. And I think a lot of baseball players today owe a great, great debt of gratitude for Dick for standing up for himself, how he's treated by the owners, by his treated by his manager, and so forth.
Well, I think you two, David Fletcher and John Owens, have done a remarkable job of doing this guy justice. I don't think he was done justice much in his life. Certainly not in this town. He loved this town, and I think this town for a short period of time loved him, but he had difficulties with the media. And once you're labeled as a malcontent, or once you're labeled as a difficult person, that is a virtually impossible thing. I know the media pretty well. It's unfair, but it's also a virtually impossible thing to shake.
Without a doubt. And I think that affected his being admitted into the Hall of Fame.
I couldn't agree with you more. Do you agree with that too, David?
I certainly do. I think that it's such a obviously I've got to know him personally. It's such a, not what Dick was about.
Yeah.
His talent was camouflaged by all this controversy.
Yep.
And he really was a very. His teammates loved him. All the stuff that he was a cancer on a team's that Bill James cast is absolutely untrue.
Yeah, that is something that courses through this book. Yeah. Not only Goose Gossage, he was an incredible kind of – he mentored young ball players. He sounds like an absolute clubhouse joy.
He was, and he was basically a co-manager with the White Sox that year. He was 30 years old. Most of the team was 23 or below.
Yeah, yeah.
Him and Wilbur Wood were the grandfathers they used to joke about at 30 years old. And so he just so misinterpreted as far as what he did. And even his incident with Frank Thomas,
yeah.
People don't realize later in life they made up, they became friends, they yeah. talked about it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I was really impressed with all the time I got to spend with Dick for the last 10 years of his life was his strong Christian faith. He didn't wear it on his sleeves, but it was something every time I had dinner with him. They prayed beforehand. Mm. He was very forgiving, very tolerant. And that came from his family. You talk about his upbringing from his mother. And I got to see it at his funeral. I mean, it was a small black Baptist church in western Pennsylvania, and it really spoke volumes about his character and who he was and how loyal he was to his friends.
Well, I also think one of the other things about him is he. The way he dressed was what you might call flamboyant. He was also a rhythm and blues singer for a time. Right. And I just think in this book, again, Chili Dog MVP, it is you help understand the times so well, David Fletcher and John Owens. In that fashion, it is really a remarkable book. Before we take a break for news, I'll leave you with this. By the 1950s, Comiskey Park had some of the most integrated large crowds in a still largely segregated Chicago. You do a great job of doing that. After the news, John Owens and David Fletcher will tell you what was going on when Mr. Allen came to town. Welcome back to Sox Fest. Chili Dog MVP, Dick Allen, the 72 White Sox. In a Transforming Chicago is an essential book for anybody who cares about this city, its sports teams, its politics, its racial history, its media history. It is on every level a remarkable book written by David Fletcher and John Owens, edited by George Castle with a foreword by Goose Gossage. He came here, he was signed in December of 1971, Dick Allen, to come to the Chicago White Sox.
Right, he was traded for Tommy John.
Right.
Who later start with the Dodgers, who was traded from the Dodgers here. And then he held out, as he usually did, and signed on April 1st or April 2nd, the same day that players went on strike for the first time in modern history. So
yes,
he walked into Sarasota on the same day that all the players walked out.
Things resonate, don't they?
We'll
get to near the end of the show. I'm going to get the opinion of both of you, David Fletcher and John Owens, about the current state of baseball. But in reading this book and learning of his years in Chicago, which I observed firsthand very closely, which you too, David, I'm assuming, saw him play.
I saw him play a lot.
And what did you think?
I was mesmerized by him, especially how he ran the bases.
Yeah.
That was the most exciting thing, to see him cut from first to third or score from second to home, just the way he cut third base. It was incredible.
He is also among the small handful of baseball players who has ever hit two inside the park home runs in the same game. Now, if that doesn't put an exclamation point on his record and his ability and someday to get in the Hall of Fame, nothing does. He had all the tools.
He did. That the game you referenced was against Hall of Famer Burt Blyleven, who actually was on the voting committee last December in Orlando to vote on Dick going to the Hall of Fame, which he lost again by one vote.
It wasn't Blylevin's vote. I'm sure he Who knows?
I suspect not, because I had talked to Blylevin a couple times about it. He loves talking about that. He's actually proud of that fact.
See, you two, in saying you talked to Blylevin, you interviewed for this book a vast array of people. I mean, how many?
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 30, 35 people.
About that. Yeah. But just not interviewed, but we had access to them all the time.
Yeah.
Where I could text them about a question, and especially the Bat Boys, Jim Riley and,
right,
and Jim O'Keefe,
right, right.
And also Rory Clark, they were just tremendous essentials to us because they provided so much background and fact-checking. And because we had the access, you know, we had access, you know, to all the key players, obviously Bill Milton, Wilbur Wood. One of the key sources for me was a pitcher, Tom Bradley, which most people in the White Sox
don't remember. Right.
Who ended up becoming the coach of the University of Maryland. And they wanted to tell their story. The time had passed, a half century. They were reflective. They were proud that it was the team that saved this franchise in Chicago. An American League charter team was going to leave. A civic institution was going to leave the city of Chicago. And they saved that team.
Talk about that. I mean, they came close to leaving.
They came close.
I mean, really close.
A number of times.
Right.
But in 1969, they really came close to leaving for Milwaukee. But Selig was actively looking for a team to replace the Milwaukee Braves, who had left after the 1965 season. And he had his eyes on the White Sox. And the White Sox actually played 10 games.
They played games up there.
In 67 and 68. And they outdrew what they did in Chicago. They drew 40, 50,000 people for each of those 10 games that they played up there.
And all of a sudden, though, when Dick Allen came here, the crowds came with him, did they not?
The crowds definitely came back. They were down to 475,000 fans in the 1970 season, and slowly came back in 71. They were up to around 800,000, but Dick, with his arrival, they were back over a million for the first time since 66.
And even in those times, I mean, as you write in the book, that there were people who were afraid to go to, you write in the book, as united as fans of all races were inside Comiskey, the communities outside the ballpark were as segregated as any city. There was trepidation, I think, wasn't there? There was fear. And you address that in this book, too. You know, the King riots earlier in the decade, the Fred Hampton murders. People were really scared. Yet, they came down for Dick Allen. And it was a good team. I mean, I'm not saying he was just out there all by himself. It was a pretty good team.
Yeah, that said, I mean, they were the top draw in Chicago for a long time. From the entire go-go White Sox era from 51 to 67, they outdrew the Cubs every year.
Which I think we're all of a certain age, people find that hard to believe, don't you think? I mean, you look at the Wrigley scene now, and, you know, 90% of the people aren't watching the game. To my mind, it's like some kind of huge place to be and thing to do, and they're not the fans I grew up with. You guys don't know that in 1961, because my mother was friendly with not only Bill Veeck, but even more friendly with Hank Greenberg, I had my 10th birthday party at that little, whatever it was, in the right field picnic area.
Well, the new picnic area.
Yeah, the brand new picnic area. And Hank Greenberg gave me, who was a very nice man, but then again, I was 10. He gave me, my brother and myself, little White Sox uniforms, Nellie Fox and Louis Aparicio uniforms.
That is a fantastic story.
It's a great story.
Yeah. Hank Greenberg figures in the book as well.
I know. How, John?
Well, Hank was a GM for Bill Veeck.
Yeah.
And he was one of the people who was considered, he had thought about buying the team, but he said he couldn't buy the team because of the active anti-Semitism among other owners.
See, this book is so beautifully and in some ways revelatorily eye-opening. It exists on so many different levels. You know, when you have encounter in the book such people as Bernie Epton was at one point part of this whole to do. Bernie Epton and Danny Thomas,
right?
We're gonna buy. Wait a minute, Bernie. Who writes a book that featured Bernie Epton, later a mayoral candidate, and Danny Thomas, and Danny Kaye is also in here. He once made a pitch to do it. Talk to me about. I'm fascinated. I got fascinated because they had drifted, frankly, from my mind. The Allen brothers. Arthur and John, who owned the team from, I think, the early 60s to 75, and explain to me, both of you, David Fletcher and John Owens, these guys are almost forgotten, except by diehard fans.
Well, I think you bring up a very important point in the book, is that John Allen is an unsung hero of the White Sox and why they're still in Chicago. And the Allen family story is fascinating. I mean, there's been four ownership groups for the White Sox in their entire existence. You had the Comiskey family, you had the Vex, and you had the Allen brothers, and then you had Vec again, and then now you've had Mr. Reinsdorf since 1981 onward. And people forget about the Allen era. But actually, the Allen era started with their father, who teamed up with Vec when he bought the team in Cleveland, and he was also an investor when Vec got the team from the oldest Comiskey kid, Dorothy.
And he was an investor with the St. Louis Browns when Vec owned the Browns.
Yeah, you have to mention the St. Louis Browns in the Eddie Goodell story, and so he. You know, Art and John, got the team. They ended up getting 100% ownership because they wouldn't sell to Chuck Comiskey, mm-hmm. the grandson of the old Roman. And so they had the team, and they renamed it White Sox Park, and they invested in the park. And, Art was trying to get a publicly financed stadium. They were going to have the Bears and the Blackhawks and the Bulls and the White Sox and Cubs and
Was it in their era that there was some talk of a South Loop?
Yes,
near Dearborn Station?
Right, yeah. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And so there was a city plan, and then there was an Allen plan. They both brought forth plans to pull all the teams together and have them play in the South Loop.
So it was, the Allen family, they ended up having the feud when Art, thought he had sold the team to Bud in September of 1969. But he had to call up Bud and say, I can't do it because my brother wants to have the team. He was basically going to call a vote to the board of directors for for the Art Nelf Corporation. And it was great. John was the unsung hero. He came forth. And he wanted the team to stay in Chicago because it was a civic institution. And that was what he was charged with. He also wanted to stay in Comiskey Park. He did not believe in publicly financed baseball stadiums.
That, to my mind, makes him a major hero in the history of Chicago. You write in the book, before we take a commercial break, John Allen must be remembered as the man responsible for maintaining an American League baseball team in this city. When the White Sox organization began faltering to a modern low attendance for Chicago baseball, he refused to give up. He was determined to keep the Chicago White Sox in Chicago and in the hands of local owners. John later severed partnerships with his brother and their company, which makes this sound very much like the Wirtz family, frankly. Thank you. That's one of the other stories in here. The Allen brothers do come off as heroes. We'll take a commercial break. Come back, and I think we'll start to talk about Harry Carey.
Great.
Chili Dog MVP is about so much more than just baseball, but if you're a baseball fan, you will devour it with relish. If you're a fan of broadcasters, I would tell you to turn first to Chapter 8. April 18th, 1972, Harry Carey's outsized personality brings back the fans. How did Harry Carey get to Chicago?
Well, Harry was a legendary broadcaster for the St. Louis Cardinals for years, mm-hmm. for over 20 years, and had a falling out with the Bush family. And
Under some speculation that he was sleeping with one of the wives of one of the Bush family, which you allude to in here.
That's correct.
Which deepens my appreciation of Harry Carey.
He ended up in Oakland working for Charlie Finley for 1 year, a year that he hated, and then ended up influenced by Jack Brickhouse, who told him, come back to Chicago. He ended up back in Chicago with the White Sox. The only problem is that the White Sox, who had been on WMAQ for the last 3 years, the WMAQ dropped them because of low ratings.
Yeah.
The team had just lost 100 games plus.
So they sort of had to piece together these small radio outlets surrounding Chicago.
That's exactly right. In Evanston and in Joliet and in a couple of LaGrange, I believe. The flagship station was WEAW in Evanston. And despite cobbling together all these small stations, Harry immediately attracted a following because he was Harry Carey and he was just a dynamic outsized person.
And another reason is that his contract, he did not get the money he was getting in St. Louis. It was much less, but his contract, if I get X more people coming in this, and they did come in large part to see, I would not pay and would not then or nor now pay any money to see Harry Carey shirtless, but but being shirtless drew fans to the ballpark. Not?
It did.
You also have in here, fellas, John Owens and David Fletcher, one of the most astonishing documents, I think, ever. Harry would go to bars every night, and he would keep a detailed record, not for future biographers, but for the IRS, so that he could write off these various adventures. On his taxes. You have in here, and it is so marvelous and stunning and fun.
It was called his drinking diary.
Yes,
and
well,
you're absolutely right. You would use it for write-offs for the IRS.
But as well it should be.
It was great. A great document because it told you how, you know, Harry interacted and how he, you know, would schmooze people after games throughout the 1972 season.
He had in 72 he documented 1,242 bar stops that included Butch McGuire's, Pub 23, Singapore, many of these places, sadly, I remember.
And legendary for Dr. Nightlife.
Ricardo's. yes, he was at Ricardo's with guests Bill Gleason, the Sun-Times columnist, Ted Williams, and Don Drysdale. Meals, $18.20. Cab, $7.40. Tips, $6. It's a remarkable document, but you guys are obviously, David and John, you're fond of Harry Carey. It comes through the pages. I mean, I think in later years he became kind of a caricature, and people made fun of him and malaprops and mispronunciations, but he was the top of the game.
Yeah, especially after his stroke, he kind of lost a little bit. But in the 70s, there was no one like him in Chicago. I mean, we were used to, you know, Jack Brickhouse,
Bob Elson,
who were great broadcasters, but they weren't colorful broadcasters like Harry was.
You bring up, that's a very interesting thing, too. It goes back to Dick Allen. Dick Allen was a relatively bland sports scene as far as we had great players here, but Gale Sayers was not flamboyant. Dick Butkus was not then flamboyant. Mike Ditka, it took years for him, was not flamboyant. The Bulls players were not flamboyant. I mean, that's another thing that raised Dick Allen above what we knew in this city.
Well, I think
Ernie Banks was not flamboyant.
Well, I like to say, and this is from my 17-year-old mindset, is that Dick Allen was Michael Jordan before there was Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
He took over the town. He had a charisma, cool. I know Rick Roker always liked to talk that said that Dick was Fonzie before there was Fonzie.
Right.
And
right.
He just was a really interesting character who was different. And for me, as a white kid in the suburbs, I was just instantly mesmerized by it and still am.
John, as you, as a black child in this city, you were 7 or 8 years old when he was here. You were obviously aware of him.
Oh, I was definitely aware of him. I admired him. My dad was a Cubs fan.
What?
Because of, you know, all the great players that they had at that time. And he was a National League fan because of the Dodgers, the Brooklyn Dodgers. But, I mean, it was hard to ignore Dick Allen because he was so flamboyant in his own way. I mean, he personally was modest, but, you know, he just looked unique. He looked like he sort of had that Superfly vibe.
Yeah.
Down to the clothes that he wore. He was a flamboyant dresser due to his wife.
He was not in the Chicago nightlife scene like someone like Joe Namath was in New York. I mean, most of his personality shown in the field.
Exactly.
Even right. though he did dress, relatively flamboyant, and maybe there would be a picture of him like that, but it was the way he played, was it not?
Yes. I mean, he always said that he put it all on the field, and that's what he did, and that's what he's being paid for. And he didn't want to be paid to do publicity events and stuff like that, though he did them. He actually did a lot in the surrounding community, both the black and white community.
He lived mostly in the suburbs, right?
He did.
For a time with one of his kids.
Yeah, and also for a time with his brother.
Brother Hank.
Who also played, who was certainly not up to his brother's caliber. But there's a wonderful thing in here where he fights for Hank to be kept on so he can get a major league pension. I found that a touching couple of sentences in your book.
Touching but controversial, because there were people who said that, you know, his brother was only there because of Dick.
And,
they had a point there.
Well, I mean, in many ways, Dick Allen was a magnet for controversy. True?
Oh, certainly was. And he was not somebody who was boastful. He was a very humble person.
Yeah.
That was a thing that I got to know him personally, I was really impressed with. And he was not someone who was going to say how good he was. He never campaigned for the Hall of Fame. It wasn't until just a few months before he died of cancer that he really thought about it, especially when I was there in Philadelphia in September of 2020 when they retired his number.
Yeah.
He was really hoping the White Sox would do that as well. And he looked back at his life, and he'd accomplished a lot. And I mean, he's the most impactful player not in the Hall of Fame in for 11-year period. He had the highest OPS percentage of any player.
Higher than Aaron, higher than all of them.
All of them. And he was just a complete player. And his biggest regret, he was never on a winner. And that was his thing. And he almost won it in 1972. If Bill Melton hadn't gotten hurt, we would have won it.
Let me ask you, should the White Sox have, even though he was not here for a great length of time, should they have been more energetic about lobbying the Hall of Fame for Dick Allen's inclusion? I think they were very energetic, and rightly so, for Minnie Minoso. Should they have been? I mean, I'm not bum-rapping Jerry Reinsdorf, but it's just a general question that I think to counteract some of the members of the Fourth Estate who looked down on Dick Allen, that there might have been mounted a more forceful campaign.
Yeah, I think the Sox, you bring up Minnie Minoso, and that's a good point. They had sort of a conflict because they had Minnie, who he had been denied for so long.
Right. Who did? I mean, I think both deserve it. Yeah.
Right. And he was the face of the franchise for over a decade. Yeah. He was an important figure for the franchise as its first black player. I do think the Phillies could have done a lot more for him. I looked at their social media, and
The Phillies could have done a lot more for him throughout his entire career, starting at the very beginning.
Well, that's certainly true, and I think, apology came way too late.
Yeah, way too late.
But I think to answer your question, I think now that Minnie is going to the Hall of Fame this July, and Dick won't be on the ballot to 2026, maybe hopefully our book will help energize the franchise. This is the guy that saved the franchise in 26 by kind of reexamining his contribution to the franchise to be behind him.
Well, I think it'll energize a lot of fans, too, out there. When we come back, I could have these guys on for 10 hours, but David Fletcher and John Owens. David Fletcher has a driver here who will somehow take him home. Nice guy. Very nice guy. He's offered me coffee and water. and I have another half hour with them. I want to talk about Nancy Faust again a little more, and about another thing that screwed up the White Sox, which was the TV deal from hell. We'll be back after the news. Welcome back. I only have 25 more minutes with David Fletcher and John Owens, the authors of Chili Dog MVP, Dick Allen, the 72 White Sox, and A Transforming Chicago. If I have not convinced you to buy this book yet, I don't know what I'm doing then. You can order it by going to Eckhart's Press, Eckhartzpress.com.
And also ChiliDogMVP.com.
Oh, that's even better. I'm not going to spell that for you people. You're smart people and you know how to read. ChiliDogMVP.com. One of the other revelations, it's about Dick Allen and the time he spent in Chicago and about his career, but it's also mostly about Chicago in a time 50 years ago before that. It's a book about history. It's a book about politics. It's a book about race relations. It's a book about the media. It's a book also about fashion, because it tells the story of Nancy Faust posing for the cover of the Chicago Tribune magazine on the directions of my great friend Genevieve Buck, Jen Buck, who was then the fashion editor. And Nancy Faust says in the book, I get this call from then Tribune fashion editor Genevieve Buck, who said, we're going to do a feature about clothing and styles. I showed up and saw two players there to do the shoot with me, and I had no idea it was going to be anything like that. I don't know what I thought it was. I just was excited that they wanted me to put these designs on. You two guys write that Nancy Faust would be, and I love this, Nancy Faust would be recognized on her own terms as an artist who innovated and influenced her peers in professional sports, just as quintessential Chicago author Nelson Algren influenced numerous important writers who followed him. What does she think of that comparison?
I don't know what she thinks of that comparison, but
I love it. But she was, and I had forgotten. You know, you forget the, in some cases, when years pass, the seed and the flowering of Chicago characters and important characters. She was innovative.
Right. You indeed. Mentioned Nelson Algren. He also was a Sox fan.
Indeed, a devoted Sox fan. Mm-hmm. And wrote much about the famous 1919 Black Sox thing, too. But Nancy Faust created not only Nana, whatever that thing is, but also songs for individual players, which was unique at the time.
Walk-up music.
Yes.
She innovated walk-up music. I mean, she's a genius. She started this early on. In 1970 is when she started with the team.
And she was a kid.
She was a kid. She was 24, 25, yeah, somewhere around there. And she was placed out in the center field bleachers, and no one was out there at the time when she started. But she came up with this idea to, you know, play little cues that were related to the players' names. So if Bill Sharp came up, she would play the Gillette theme. There's just hundreds and hundreds of little tunes that she would play to support, you know, whatever player was coming up to the plate.
And what did she pick? What did she pick? Now, you people out there of a certain age, try to remember what she played when Dick Allen would stride to the plate. I'm going to give you 2 seconds. Tell your wife, tell your husband. Remember? Okay, what was it?
It was Jesus Christ Superstar.
That is an Inspired, which was a hit show at the time. That's an Inspired choice.
Well, it was what invented walk-up music.
Yeah.
Before he died, when I was in Philadelphia with him for the retirement ceremony, I got him and Nancy hooked up, and she had done a little playing of Jesus Christ Superstar, and it meant so much to him, especially as he was battling for his life, having lung cancer. And they were special, and she was an innovator, and she's extremely Very, very humble about her contribution to Americana. But, you know, the White Sox should be very proud. 41 years she was there.
Oh, my God, yeah, which is astonishing. I didn't realize that.
And you have to remember, again, 1972, there's no sound system.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, it's the PA announcer and Nancy.
Yeah.
And so she was a command performance. And what she did was so innovative. And obviously, you know, with later with Take Me Out to the Ball Game with Harry Carey and the Na Na Hey Hey song, which is the most famous sports taunting song of all time because of Nancy. I mean, she's an institution, and she really, in my opinion, deserves to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
I agree.
Because of what she contributed to the game.
Right. No question. I think if you asked if fans voted for the Hall of Fame, she would have been in long, long ago. Another fascinating character in this book is Roland Heeman. Remind people who he was.
Well, Roland Heeman was the general manager of the White Sox from 1971 to 1985. In the beginning, he was just the director of player personnel, but he was the...
He's the guy who traded for Dick Allen.
He was came from a baseball family. He just recently died in December of 2021. He was a baseball wizard. He was the person who knew everybody. I was very fortunate. I got to be very close with Roland. And he just was an institution. He created the team that turned around the White Sox from 71 to 72. And he obviously was he won the MLB Executive of the Year in 1972.
Right.
He won it later in 1983 with the winning ugly team.
He said this, and you devote a lot, you justifiably and rewardingly for me, devote a lot of space to him. And he said, this is one of the many things you have him saying here, I always say a player wears his uniform, but there's a human being in that uniform. So if you treat the players like you do your own children, then you're going to get better results. So you give them every chance to succeed, and sometimes you have to scold them a little bit or have somebody shake them up. I guarantee you there's no general manager in professional sports who would say something that knowing, that accurate, and that incisive. I really, really believe that he was something. We will, when we come back, we will... Did we already mention that Victor Skrebneski, the famous late photographer, is the one who took the cover shot for the Tribune magazine at the time? I do want to talk about for a second. We got a couple minutes here. The Sox made a miserable, horrible deal TV-wise, going with, you know, Marshall Field's new station, UHF. My father worked for the station when Marshall first started, but then Marshall died. The whole thing was a disaster, was it not?
Right. Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at first because they got $1 million
right.
a year from WFLD, but WFLD and UHF wasn't quite ready.
Oh, my God, you needed like a can on top of your TV to get the thing. I remember it very, very well.
Right.
You needed more than that in Glen Ellen. It was hard to get a single.
Oh, my God,
you're
right.
It was like ghost-like images.
Yes, and the images were bad. And that really contributed to damaging the Sox. Because if you're on TV, people see a nice stadium, they say, let's go to the game. I mean, it's simple kind of marketing, I think. And that was a... That was a disaster.
Yeah, the thing is, they were on WGN with the Cubs.
Right.
They were both primarily being telecast from home. There weren't a lot of road games that were being telecast for either team
in
66. And Art Allen felt that, you know, that there was more more attention paid to the Cubs. They were playing in the daytime, so they had more games on WGN than the Sox. The Sox didn't have a lot of night games aired on WGN. So they thought, you know, Art Allen thought, We'll go with this new fledgling station, and we'll be given total attention. We'll have more games on. We'll have more money. But the thing is that UHF just wasn't accessible to a lot of people in 1967 and 68.
That's it's a great chapter. It's a really great chapter that explains a lot about modern or soon-to-be modern media. One last thing before we take our last break, and thank you two guys for coming in, David Fletcher and John Owens. This has been... the book is better than sitting and talking to you two guys. I have to tell you that. But this is an embellishment that is very entertaining to me. I will also tell you that one of the things you learn in the book, that of all the many mayors of Chicago, and I would assume every other town in this country, Mayor Richard J. Daley was the only mayor anybody knows who bought his own tickets to the games. That's great. He did a lot for Chicago. That is to his great credit. We'll take one last commercial break, come back, and say goodbye to these guys. Again, ChiliDogMVP.com is a place. Is that it, John?
Yep. ChiliDogMVP.com.
Order the book. It'll change your life in a lot of good ways. We'll be back. The end of Chili Dog MVP gets kind of sad in that Dick Allen's life was filled with a lot of pain during the last years. He got remarried, but then he lost a daughter.
Yeah, she was murdered.
Yeah. And a lot of people, and you know, the thing about him, he didn't tell friends. I mean, there are a lot of his friends and people who knew him and admired him who never didn't learn about that for 40 years or something.
It wasn't something he talked about, but he did bring up Terry when he got his number retired by the Phillies, and I was really proud that he did that.
He also said at a press conference, the fans of Chicago have done a lot for me. And he was very emotional when he said this. I don't know if you were there, David Fletcher, when he said this. But the fans of Chicago have done a lot for me. I don't say I've been fair to the people in baseball, but sometimes they haven't been fair to me. Coming to Chicago made a human being out of me. That is at once chilling and exciting. And that says a great deal about the kind of book you guys have written, because you capture that. You capture that. Made a human being out of me. You also do a very nice job of sort of where are they now at the very end, which I think is wonderfully necessary, even though some people are dead. And again, you do mention that I can't. The whole notion that Nancy Faust is now 74 is too chilling for me, but the fact that she has two donkeys still at her farm.
74 and very active.
What?
74
and very active. Oh, I'm sure. I mean, most people 74 are.
She still wishes she was playing at the ballpark.
Does she?
Yes, she does.
What does she do? Does she perform anywhere at all?
Yes, she does a lot of performances at various places, and she does a lot of shows and stuff like that. I mean, she's still a master of her craft.
Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet.
She performed at the Kane County Cougar Games for
Two
games a few years ago.
Before I let you guys go, and again, thank you for devoting this much time to this. The book, again, ChiliDogMVP.com will get you the book. And it will, it's Dick Allen, the 72 White Sox, and a transforming Chicago. It will literally transform your memories because it will enrich them. Talk to me for a second about the contretemps between Dick Allen and Ron Santo.
Well, Santo came over in 1974.
Right.
He refused the trade to the Angels. It was the first 5-10 player to refuse.
Right.
It was called the Santo Rule. And so Roland Heeman, the designated hitter rule had been started in baseball in the American League in 1973, acquired Santo from the Cubs for the 1974 season, and it was a disaster because he didn't want to be a DH. He wanted to play third base, and they already had Bill Milton there.
Yeah.
And so there was a big feud between Dick and Ron because Ron wanted to be the leader, and Dick was already the leader of the team, and it caused a lot of conflict. And both in their own autobiographies write about the conflict, and both say one of the reasons why they left baseball or left the Sox was because of their relationship.
The other one. How good is, I'm sure it's flawed, but I don't mean to say that. How good is Dick Allen's autobiography?
It's actually pretty good. It was written with a writer from Philadelphia, Tim Whitaker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think he doesn't reveal a lot about himself. He reveals a lot about the racial stuff that he grew up with. I think it's good about that. I think there were some things that could have been better. I think it still stands up. I know that he knew before he died that I was working on this, and I knew that he felt that I could do it justice. So I feel like I'm carrying his spirit with John's help, and you know. So,
how was the, not to get into the nitty gritty of of writing, but how was the collaboration? How did you do that? Would you alternate chapter? I mean, the book comes off as one very knowledgeable and passionate voice, and it's a combined voice.
Yeah, we alternated chapters, and George Castle was right. Obviously a big help as well. But we definitely tried to ensure that we had the same voice when we were writing about different things happening. I concentrated a little bit more on what was happening in the city at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Doc handled a lot of – Doc knew Dick better than I did.
Sure.
So a lot of the inside information about Dick came from Doc. So, but I think that we did a good job, you know, communicating about how we wanted to present the story and present it within the same voice.
What surprised you the most, John Owens, about this tale?
What surprised me the most is, you know, Dick's personality. I think that you know, I knew he was a dynamic player. I didn't realize that he had such an influence on his team.
Yeah,
and that he was such a mentor to so many different people on his team.
Yeah, I think that's something that will come as a revelation to most people who read the book, because that was not the image that was portrayed in the press. Do you think he was treated fairly or unfairly by the so-called media, which then was basically newspapers?
Right. I think he was definitely treated unfairly, especially early on in Philadelphia. I think he had a better relationship with writers after a while here in Chicago. Yeah, Bob Marcus specifically was close to him, and other writers, Jerome Holtzman was relatively close to him. But, yeah, I think that the media, he definitely had his issues with the media, and he had problems communicating with the media as well. He wasn't upfront with the media because he wanted to protect himself.
Yeah, he didn't go out drinking with the media, right, which sometimes can endear you to them.
Right.
David, any revelations here? Anything surprise you? You knew him. You saw him play. You knew him well. You carried his coffin at his funeral. Was there anything about Dick's life and the stuff you might have learned about Chicago, being a, no offense, but a suburban kid, that surprised you?
I think the surprise was just how much he's beloved by his teammates, because everybody said that he was such a cancer for his team, and he was beloved. I mean, the Tribune's coverage after he died said it all. You know, he was beloved. Paul Sullivan did a great for the Tribune wrap up of his life, what he meant to the city of Chicago, and that was what I think really surprised me. It was after talking to all this. I mean, he was a fourth of the payroll. You know, a couple of players in '73 got released because of Dick's salary.
Yeah, that's an astonishing thing too. In the book, he was literally 1/4 of the entire payroll of the team.
But he also accounted for probably $1.5 million of the revenue.
I'm not disputing that. But it's still, that's a stunning kind of figure.
It is, but I think it was his worth and what he was for the team. And I just think what I really enjoyed with the book was, and you talk about the collaboration, it was John and I and George. We talked constantly. We also had a lot of other help. Media veteran Tom Shearer was basically the fifth Beatle on the book.
He's
a proofreader in the book. He really should be on the cover.
The great Tom Weinberg, of course.
So we had all those folks, and we had a lot of folks like Bruce Levine, and they all gave their insight. And I think that's what was fun about it, was some of Chicago's most elite baseball fans or writers
and observers and
contributed, and even the politics aspect of it.
Yeah. You're going to come out, I'm sure, with a second edition of the book. Are you going to expand it, or what?
What do you think?
I think we want to expand a little bit. I mean, there's some more graphics we want to do. I think we would like to, we would like to get some more of the politics. We certainly like to get an interview with Jesse Jackson, who's an important character in this book.
No question.
And I think that aspect, you know, would be nice to get Mayor Daley's son to be
Richard
able to comment.
Richard M. Daley.
So he was our chili dog chef. Jim O'Keefe. That was his sixth grade basketball coach in Bridgeport. So it's just a great family story.
I also think that when people read the book, there will be people who don't come out of the woodwork, but people who have a place in this story that you may never, I may never, you may never have heard of, who might have something important to say.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's not a baseball book. Baseball is a theme. It's a Chicago book.
Yeah.
And that's what we really want to emphasize. We want to tell that story with a main character, with a lot of Shakespearean overtones as far as the drama and characters.
I hope you get to talk to Richard M. Daley, who is still out and about, because when I talked to him years ago, he told the most charming story about his dad, Richard J. Daley, coming home, not every night, but many nights, and taking off his coat and playing catch in the backyard in Bridgeport. And it was, he said, that is what made him fall in love with baseball. This book will make you fall in love with David Fletcher and John Owens, among many things. It is called Chili Dog MVP, Dick Allen, The 72 White Sox and a Transforming Chicago. Is one of the best, most knowledgeable and entertaining books I have ever read about Chicago. So thank you guys. Thank you guys
for writing it. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for coming in here. Thanks, Krista. Thanks, Brett. See you all next week.